the crystal clear water of the underground pool slid off the shimmering blue-green scales of the naked serpent woman as she walked up the slope of the beach. She climbed past the water's edge on long, sinewy legs. The serpentess ran slender, deceptively delicate fingers down her body, wiping away droplets that clung to her curvaceous form. A sarong of flowered blue silk lay in a puddle on a flat rock that she used as a table, and she picked it up once she had assured herself that her scaled flesh had been brushed clean, no dewy droplets remaining to mar the simple wrap. The cloth snugged around her sleek, full hips, covering her from her vestigial navel down to just above her knees. With a deft fold, she looped a ribbon-like strap around her neck, covering her breasts, a throwback to her mammalian hybrid heritage. The wrap obscured her nearly invisible nipples in the center of each glimmering orb. The women of the Naga, entitled Nagani, betrayed their half-human heritage, possessing the curves reminiscent of human female anatomy, and as such had developed a need for concealing those differences from their male counterparts.
Anna, my queen. My apologies.
Her bodyguard stood in the cavernous tunnel to the subterranean lagoon.
May this unworthy servant enter your glorious presence.
Come in, Manticore. There is nothing unworthy about you. And I am not queen yet.
The bodyguard was 6.5 feet tall, lithe limbs resembling thick cords of steel cable, having a silvery burnish as they ran down from copper-brown shoulders. Manticore, like all Naga men, was naked from the waist up, clad only in pants from his hips to his knees. The tough chest plates that rolled down his torso were the same hard, sandy shells that protected the soles of his feet, surer protection and traction than any hand-cobbled footwear. Like many of the Naga, his toes had fused together, giving him the illusion of shoes. Those who had been gifted with the change and whose lower bodies had become truly serpentine were considered the children of their creator. Such instances were rare, resulting in beings who had to drag themselves along by their arms, resting on a long, undulating monolimb that was not designed for supporting the weight of a human torso.
Najadurga has returned from his recent expedition. He requests the company of his promised bride.
In other words, I'm home. Where is my fuck?
I am sorry, Excellence.
Hannah ran her delicate fingertips across the tough chest plates on the snake man's pectoral muscles. Her hazel eyes sought his, penetrating deep into their brown, smoldering depths.
I am sorry as well, my loyal protector. I meant no crudeness for your ears. Tell my cousin that if he wishes to see me, he can find me in my chambers.
He won't be pleased.
If Durga deems it necessary to punish you, he will never know my touch again. No, he'll know the touch of my foot as I kick him to death.
Manticore stepped away from her touch. Shame had smothered whatever joy had been awakened by Hannah's caress. Manticore's duty was to the Naga Protectorate, the elite who defended the royal family. That duty meant that he would give his life for the precious Princess Hannah. In the larger scheme of things, it meant that he had to ensure that the Crown Prince's bride would bear him the means to carry on his family dynasty. His life, influenced by an affection and attraction to Hannah, was commanded by an oath to see the thing he loved most in the world hauled off to an embittered being who saw her only as a means to extend his genetic viability. Hannah regretted being so familiar with Manticore, speaking the thoughts that flashed behind her eyes. She regretted that his devotion to her had sparked a kindred love. Manticore was the shining knight every girl wanted, be they human or Naga. Tall, strong, and selflessly committed to her, Manticore was Hannah's, body and soul. All she had to do was ask, and he'd be hers forever. Were there a place for the two Naga to flee in the human world, she would abandon her crown and leave with him. Instead, she was trapped. Serpents were not welcome above ground, and the humans who interacted with the Naga were rare outside of the underground realm. Hannah and Manticore would be hunted by snake and shunned by man.
I will tell Najadurga of your intentions. The intention to wait for him in your chambers, not the kicking thing.
Hannah gave him a weak smile, then the official gesture of dismissal. Released, the bodyguard left the lagoon chamber, and his discomfort faded. Hannah watched him bow as he left the private swimming area, then made her way slowly to her chambers. Durga rolled over, spent in his carnal energies. His member retreated back into its protective sheath of armored scales, smearing his and Hannah's juices on the flat plates of his groin.
Be a dear, and clean our mess off me.
I am a princess of the blood, not some bathing maid. Wash yourself off.
She rolled on the mattress, pulling away from his grasp, staring at the tapestry on her chamber wall. Hannah hunched her shoulders, trying to create a wall between Durga and herself. Powerful fingers dug into her shoulder, and he whipped her around. She looked at the damaged scales over his right eye. The scar was a livid, jagged slash carved into his armored skin. His once golden iris was muted as it swam in a bloodshot orb. It was a memento of his encounter with the humans of the Millennial Consortium. The eye that peered at her looked harsh, unhealthy.
Your king demands your service.
Hannah's upper lip curled back, her fangs flexing into position.
You'll regret it.
Durga pushed her away, sitting up.
We are of the same royal blood. Your venom wouldn't harm me.
No, but my teeth are still sharp enough to tear parts of you to shreds.
Hannah exited the bed to get away from him.
You would end the line of the true blood? For what? The sake of your dignity? No matter what you do, you're still a queen.
She tugged her wrap around her naked form, stepping closer to the chamber entrance.
Then why act as if I'm just a whore?
Take one more step, and it will be you who will harbor regrets.
If your touch leaves a mark, the Naga will forget about your pure blood and let you know how they feel about your bigotry. The bulk of your people are new bloods, so you don't have much room to alienate them.
There is always Manticore.
You wouldn't.
He will follow my orders. He would assault the gates of hell armed with a toothpick if I told him to. He will do his duty. And his duty, ultimately, is my will. And if my will is his death...
I would damn you to hell. But you'd take charge of the place inside of 10 minutes.
Come here. On your knees.
Hannah clenched her golden eyes shut, tear ducts burning like acid.
Your dignity or your duty? Make your choice.
Hannah's eyes snapped open in a glare, but in her heart she knew the true choice didn't involve the pride of either of the royal Nagas. The life of Manticore, a good and selfless being, was at stake. Even if Hannah hadn't harbored affection for the loyal Manticore, she couldn't allow harm to come to one of her people, especially when she had a say in the matter. It was her duty as ruler to sacrifice for her people, she told herself. Not completely, she corrected. Her decision was somewhat self-serving. As long as Manticore lived, there was a chance that they would have an opportunity to become lovers, to grow old together. She stepped to Durga, knelt, closed her eyes, and thought of Manticore. Whenever Hannah was called to bed with the True Blood Prince, Manticore always found it easier to be elsewhere in the ancient caverns of the Naga. He wasn't blind to the affection that she showed him, but he also knew that such love was a leash that Durga wielded to control his chosen bride. Hannah only vaguely alluded to her dealings with Durga, but the hints formed an ugly picture that made Manticore regret the strength of his fealty to the royal family. Durga's father, Garuda, had died defending their underworld realm. He had fallen as he battled against armored invaders from across the Pacific Ocean. The humans had called themselves magistrates, and they sought the technology of the Naga, most especially the ancient genetic manipulation devices left behind by their creator, one of the dragon gods of the stars. The capacity for cloning and human alteration was too important to the hybrid barons who ruled America. Though they had their own genetics program and production facility, the thought of others possessing such advancements was anathema to them. Garuda, the fallen king, had offered to share with the barons, but greed had proved too much to allow such a compromise. The shooting war was brief and savage. Garuda had led the Naga warriors in a conflict against the baronial expeditionary force. The magistrates had been exterminated, but at enormous cost, with Garuda dying as he destroyed the last of the Deathbird helicopters. Mortally wounded by the gunship's machine gun, Garuda struck the craft out of the sky with a shoulder-fired rocket. The destruction of the human marauders became known as the Battle of Skyspear, one of the greatest victories and tragedies in the history of the Cobra people. That was where Durga's spite for the mammals had been born. Durga was only in his teen years, a young warrior who fought alongside his father as a gunner on a jeep. He watched as the humans' bullets tore into his father's flesh, and his vengeful thirst had not been slaked in 30 years of bloodshed. That was decades ago, and since then, Durga had spread the influence of the Naga dynasty throughout the region. Raids against human settlements produced results that impressed the queen, Maitra Nyun. Converts among the imprisoned slaves were passed through the cobra baths, solutions of nanomachines and saline that stripped the majority of their mammalian nature, all save a warm-blooded metabolism, and replaced it with the serpentine perfection that had been a gift from the dragon god Enki. Human cultists were readily accepted into the ranks, provided they survived the harrowing trek to the Kashmir across the radioactive wastelands, bandit-controlled territories, and the ferocious predators of the wilderness. Unfortunately, few of these believers, now called pilgrims, even knew of the hidden Naga Empire. Even fewer had the endurance to survive such a murderous journey. Manticore's father had been one such man. His mother was a convert from the enslaved humans captured by the grim Prince Durga in the time before the prince's rage consumed every waking moment. Technically, Manticore's birth by two new bloods, or converts to Naga form, and the fact that he was born a serpent, not needing the cobra baths, made him a true blood. Unfortunately, Durga had long ago decreed that only the royal family could call themselves true bloods, as they could trace their lineage back to the age of the Dragon Kings. Manticore didn't have the right to that title. The best that he could hope for was the mantle of Pilgrim's Son. A cordon of guards entered the cavernous hall that Manticore had wandered into. He immediately recognized them as the ring of living armor that surrounded the Queen Matron as she moved among her citizens. The Snake Man dropped to one knee, lowering his head in deference to the Grand Matriarch. The phalanx of guards halted in front of Manticore.
Mani, child, rise and gaze upon your queen.
Had she been human, her age might have proved more readily apparent. Still, 6 decades had done little to dull the copper and black leopard pattern of her scales, and her golden eyes were as bright and fiery as freshly lit bonfires. The only sign of her advanced years was a looseness of her skin and a softening of the firmness of her once tight, perfect musculature. Her lips turned up in a smile, matched by the warmth in her gaze as she extended a delicate hand to Manticore.
Matron?
Mani, it's good to see you in health. How does my daughter-to-be fare?
She fares well.
I take it my son is sampling the wine before he pays for the vineyard?
Manticore couldn't suppress a flash of a grin at the queen's crack. While Prince Durga's decades of warfare had expanded the safe zone around the Naga's subterranean homelands and had been responsible for tripling the population of the Cobra folk, Yun had little patience for her son's recent violent activities. She was troubled by the wanton murder of travelers, as well as the growth of Durga's increasingly militaristic personal guard. The rumors of his disrespectful relations with Hannah were particularly distressing. Hannah had survived far longer than her predecessors, young women who had died in accidents or quietly withdrew themselves from public life after a few meetings with the prince. It had become an increasing concern that the matron would never have a grandchild to carry on her bloodline. Manticore knew the queen's feelings in the matter of her sole surviving child, but he didn't want word passing through the ranks that he had been amused at Yun's sharp criticism of Durga's behavior.
I apologize, Matron Yun.
My fault entirely. My son has just returned from an expedition along the old Pakistani border, and he claimed that he has found several items of interest. Since you seem weighted by your thoughts, I wonder if you would enjoy a distraction with an old, wrinkled serpent hag.
If there were a wrinkled hag present, I'd do so. But for now, I am overjoyed to accompany a resplendent goddess of the blood.
If I were a few decades younger, Manticore, I'd believe you.
She offered her hand, and the cobra warrior crooked his arm for her.
It might even be that you carry some of the spark of Garuda in you. You resemble my husband, and his genetic code runs through every pilgrim.
I am flattered, my queen, but your son has likened the process to adding 2 drops of wine to a vat of sewage. It remains vile waste. while adding 2 drops of sewage to a vat of wine turns it all to sewage.
The Naga, however, are neither waste nor beverage. My son, in his advancing years, seeks to overturn the teachings of both Naga and humankind, including the lessons of those who despised the institutional bigotry of caste systems.
And yet we are still a monarchy.
With safeguards and the ability to impeach those of royal blood. A human once said that the tree of liberty at times must be watered with the blood of tyrants and free men alike.
Thomas Jefferson, words from nearly 500 years ago.
Truth does not cease to be truth because of age, my boy.
The pair and the silent cordon of Cobra escorts entered the alcove where Durga had deposited his discoveries. Off to one side of the underground hangar, the Naga fleet of 20th century Black Hawk and Deathbird helicopters rested. 100 aircraft, only minutes from life should the children of Enki need them. The air fleet had been recovered thanks to raids on Indian government installations. The Battle of Skyspear taught the Naga the need for air power as they had suffered terrible losses, aside from Garuda himself, to the Magistrate's assault helicopters. The Deathbirds and their utility transport counterparts were the backbone of a secure homeland now. Quarantined and protected by Durga's expeditionary troopers sat a strange and impressive object. It was sleek and silver, the size of the Black Hawk, and covered in burns and scars as if it had been engulfed in lava.
What is it, Matron?
The Dragon Kings. That is one of their craft. And if they have returned...
Returned? But Tiamat was struck from the skies.
Yun's golden eyes flashed as she looked at the skimmer.
Death is no impediment to a god.
Austin Fargo was glad to be in a set of clean clothes, and after the luxury of a hot shower, he felt like a new man. He cast a cursory glance toward the doorway of the locker room, noticing Lakesh brooding there. The Indian scientist looked far younger than the consortium's initial intelligence had described him. Fargo didn't think that nanotechnology existed at such a level to create that drastic a change of physiology, but the scientist was living proof. With such a display, it wasn't hard for the consortium explorer to agree with the theory of nanorobotic augmentation creating a post-human species such as the Naga.
You had something to ask me?
No. I came here to thank you. It's not every day that the woman I love volunteers for such a dangerous journey just to keep her eye on me.
And that's my fault?
Absolutely. You are the one who literally stirred up a nest of snakes. And don't think that we're not aware that you just might be setting us up.
I've been threatened and bullied ever since your pale little bitch pointed a crossbow at me, Lakesh. This shit has grown ancient fast. Do you honestly think I'm so smug that I don't realize your crew can kill me like a mouse in a trap?
No one from the consortium has ever proved to be anything close to reliable or trustworthy, unless one specifically wants a knife in the back. You cost them a lot in terms of your murdered expedition. So even if you're not offering us to the consortium on a silver platter, they'll be watching you.
And I'm not gonna lie that I don't expect them to make another go at the Naga and their stockpiles. But you checked me over. No transmitters, no hidden comms, no locator devices.
If Domi gets hurt, I will hold you personally responsible.
Understood.
Lakesh handed Fargo his confiscated revolver.
You'll need something more if you expect to pull your weight.
I escaped the last time only because I carried a minimum of gear. I don't know about guys like Grant, but I don't carry the kitchen sink with me.
I'm not a pack mule either.
I just can't see slogging all the way back to the Kashmir with bags of guns and grenades.
Who said that we were walking?
Oh, yeah. The Matran system. But would the facilities in the subcontinent be sufficient to get us close to the Naga?
We have the means to travel...
Lakesh debated whether to continue. He realized that he would not be able to disguise the interphaser's improvements on Matran's technology.
Your new invention... The one that lets you pop in on ancient temples?
The millennialists had representatives present at the tomb of Wan Di, intermediaries between the ancient Chinese warlord and the Anunnaki, to recover his rejuvenating armor. Obviously, they had reported back about the interphaser.
How does it work? Magnetic fields? Come on, Lakesh. Who am I gonna tell? And how could I ever decipher the necessary mathematical formulas? I'm a tomb digger, not a theoretical physicist.
No, but that won't keep gun-toting thugs from trying to abscond with it. It's been sought after before, and lives have been lost in the process.
Do I look like I can let them in on your secrets? Do I have some magic invisible phone to call them with? Or a bionic transceiver like you guys have?
No. We searched you carefully. Nothing popped up.
But you're still worried about me. What kind of a trap could I put you all in?
I can think of 20 or 30, not to mention the suspicions of my cohorts. Even without your friends in the consortium.
They are not my friends anymore. Not after I blew it in India.
Well, without them, you have the Naga and whatever they have. Not to mention other interested parties who have access to technology that we can't detect. The Anunnaki and other parties have demonstrated access to extrasensory means of communication.
Other parties?
There are records of dozens of species of hybrid beings represented in mythology. The Naga are only one such breed. My compatriots and I have encountered others in our travels.
The creations of the Anunnaki?
Precisely.
But what about Tiamat? That fireworks display must have taken care of them and whatever freak armies they had.
Marduk is alive, and he's looking for the means to regain his old status as a god. We stopped him once, but we may not be lucky the next time. There are also his surviving brethren, time travelers, colonies of malcontents in suspended animation.
So why are you rushing off to India, if you're so certain that there are all these deadly threats out there?
I'd rather die trying than let those monsters go unopposed.
Oh, so you're all suicidal. Then why worry about me?
Shut your foolish mouth. Suicide is the furthest thing from my mind. I hate risking the lives of my friends.
But you are definitely damned if you sit on your hands. At least this way you've got a chance. A snowball's chance in hell.
You say another word about failure and I will personally strangle you to death.
Lakesh left Fargo alone in the locker room. There was a grim silence when Fargo finally joined Kane, Lakesh, and the others in the Mattrans chamber. Obviously, Lakesh had spoken of their conversation. Domi's eyes had a particularly demonic aspect to them, the blood-colored jewels glaring at Fargo as if lit from behind by the fires of hell. The archaeologist looked to the others, whose quiet demeanors held more than just impatience. He then looked down to the floor of the chamber, spotting a small pyramid-shaped device.
That's the interphaser?
Yeah. Go ahead and pick it up.
Fargo wisely kept his distance from the pyramid.
Dumb enough to talk shit about me? Smart enough not to commit suicide, more or less.
Enough. We got work to do. Bridget, Baptiste, fire it up.
Bridget put in the coordinates. The familiar, mist-like fan of light emerged from the apex of the pyramid. Each one stepped into it and disappeared from sight. When Fargo's senses returned, he found himself in a darkened, cavernous temple. He recognized the markings on the floor, despite the cracks and wear of antiquity. They were in northern India, and he didn't doubt that they were near the countryside where he'd encountered the murderous Naga squadron. He remained still and glanced at the others, who were obviously accustomed to the disorientation of matter transfer.
A temple?
Many of the ancient peoples knew that there were places of power favorable to communicating with their gods. Those areas were actually parallax points, convergences of magnetic lines of force that allowed access to other dimensions.
Like ley lines? So where they cross, the fabric of reality is thin enough to open a wormhole?
Right. The interphaser is programmed with remote access points.
The little pyramid is useless otherwise, huh?
A good magician never gives away his secrets. You'll have to pry the secrets out of my skull.
Don't tempt him, Lakesh. Who knows who this bastard's shacked up with?
What do I have to do to get you assholes to trust me?
Die taking a bullet for one of us.
Or how about you quit calling us assholes? It's rude. It's very rude.
Kane returned from a perimeter sweep of the temple, and Fargo glanced at him for support.
They never let anything go, do they?
Not even if you are their friend. All right, the temple is secure. No sign of Fargo's buddies or walking snake men.
I didn't think anyone else would be here. The Naga keep a tight perimeter on their frontier. Plus, to get here, they'd have to know the existence of parallax points, wouldn't they?
Fargo has a point. Even if his alleged allies had some sort of psychic connection, the Naga's defenses are between them and us.
There's other threats to deal with here anyway. Bandits and local predators are just as much of a problem.
I don't think that the Naga would tolerate human bandits in their area of control.
And the bandits would not want to deal with a force stronger than they are. That doesn't mean that the snakes won't have humans on their side.
So, what's the plan? Stumble around looking for a snake hole?
Actually, Fargo, we're going to avoid making the same mistakes you did.
Grant helped Lakesh set up the mobile field radio he had hauled along with them in a duffel bag.
You're going to call them?
Despite our success in turning societies upside down, we actually do try to be diplomatic.
It's easier to make friends than enemies. Saves wear and tear on our guns, too.
Would you please be quiet? It's hard enough to seek out active communications bands without your chatter drowning out weak signals.
You heard him! Go chat outside!
I don't like the sound of this. You're just gonna broadcast...
Do we look like fused out idiots to you? Lakesh is listening for short-range broadcasts that our satellites couldn't pick up due to atmospheric interference. He's listening for chatter first, boosting the signal through the field radio for further analysis at Cerberus.
Are all the Cerberus people so smarter than now, or is it just you three?
First you want us to trust you, then you antagonize us. Make up your mind!
To lessen her frustration, Bridget busied herself using a digital camera to record scroll markings on the ancient temple.
Can you make something out of this, Baptiste?
Subcontinental pictograms aren't my forte. Plus, these examples are considerably deteriorated. Still, look at these figures.
Kane squinted, leaning in closer to the markings. He could make out the images, worn by time, of normal-looking men interacting with cobra-hooded humanoids.
I was hoping there'd be something more readable. It'd be nice to know exactly who we're dealing with.
Well, traditionally, the Naga and humankind in Indian mythology interacted peacefully. The cobra, while a dangerous animal, is also respected and revered.
Same goes for the Japanese and serpents. Fear and respect.
But the Japanese do not have an analog for the Naga, as far as we can tell. You'd have to go to the mainland, places like Thailand, for snake-like humanoids.
That's not too far away, relatively speaking. Just sail along the coast and you can reach Thailand easily. Not like crossing the South China Sea.
There are also snake-human hybrid beings in Middle Eastern lore, such as the Lamia. Though their examples display more serpentine bodies, which don't match the descriptions Fargo gave us.
I saw Naga at various stages of transformation.
Their nature may be fluid if they were acted on by an outside source. Some genetic structures would be more resistant to alteration than others, while some might have mutated to become completely limbless. Look at this figure. What does it resemble?
Anunnaki Overlord.
A snake face. If the Naga are on good terms with them, maybe diplomacy isn't the best tack.
Not necessarily. Enki had sway over India, according to Balaam's accounting of the rift between Anunnaki factions. Enki was a beneficent being who was opposed to the enslavement of humanity.
Enlil didn't like his brother too much, so he would work against Enki's pattern. The Nephilim are mindless drones, perfect for subjugation and as cannon fodder.
So it might stand to reason that the Nephilim, in their reptilian nature, are Enlil's answer to Enki's creation. This figure is definitely a respected and revered being, and his cobra subjects are bearing gifts of some sort.
These figures don't represent the cannon fodder. The Naga are bearing the gifts of language, knowledge, and invention. They're also noted as being his children, not his slaves. They were also his ambassadors to humanity. So what changed?
The Archon Megacull and subsequent Age of Barbarism would have lowered the Naga's trust of the human race.
It would have made things a lot easier if they were all good or all evil.
Life is rarely that simple, Grant.
What's wrong?
I picked up scrambled signals while monitoring Naga transmissions. While I couldn't hear anything on the signals because of their encryption, I was able to have Bri analyze a sample.
Let me guess, Lakesh. The Overlords?
None other. Actually, the signal resembles Enlil's work as Colonel Thrush, but with some modifications.
That would make sense. Enlil is currently without resources after the fall of Tiamat. He'd look for alternative means to bolster his power.
And what better way than to steal his baby brother's children? He gets revenge on Enki, and he grabs an army with access to the best military technology the human race has developed.
Any clue who was talking, Lakesh?
No. The encryption also hampered signal triangulation. We do have one bit of news, though.
What's that?
Fargo's sparring partner, the good Prince Durga, returned to their lair with a badly damaged spacecraft, according to a new report.
The Naga have found a dropship. But did Durga take it, or was it handed over to him?
Does it matter?
It does, Fargo. Because if Durga was given the ship as a gift, it means that there's going to be a faction of the Naga who won't have an interest in peace with humans.
Durga fucked the consortium hard enough without Anunnaki technology.
Crudely put, but to the point. We'll have to step carefully.
But Enlil wouldn't have the resources to be a threat, would he?
Maybe not.
Just because the devil doesn't have his hellfire does not mean that he's without his other tricks.
The Cerberus warriors looked out into the forest engulfing the temple, dread smothering the air around them. Hannah reached out to a patch of undamaged hull, seeing the reflection of her hand before touching the smooth skin. She expected it to feel cold, but there was a warmth in the unblemished section, as if it were living flesh. She glanced at Queen Yun and Durga quizzically.
What is it? It is the Chariot of the Gods.
It is a ship that didn't quite escape the destruction of a larger craft in orbit. It had crash-landed on the border of Pakistan. We encountered imposter creatures within.
The Nephilim. The children of Enlil.
Whatever. There had been a few survivors in the craft, but we dealt with them.
And brought their carcasses back for what? Display as trophies?
Hannah looked at the bodies laid out on tables next to the charred saucer. Save for their lack of hoods and their duller scale coloration, they could have easily been mistaken for Naga.
And Enlil is just a creation myth, isn't he? Enlil was the brother of our creator, Enki. Where Enki was wise and nurturing, Enlil was a schemer, seeking his own personal profit. The gods clashed often, and the Naga were the greatest weapon of our father. Enlil's Nephilim had great strength and possessed powerful weapons, but they were no match for a free people who could think for themselves.
That is ancient mythology, Mother. Who knows how the victors edited the history books?
Yun's eyes softened into sadness as she regarded the Naga prince. Hannah watched Manticore's hood flex in unspoken tension over Durga's disrespect for kin and queen. Durga's presence made every conversation a minefield. His barely contained rage seethed below the surface, seeking violent release over the slightest disagreement. It now seemed as if the raids against their human neighbors above the ground were no longer a sufficient distraction. Hannah brushed her fingertips across the blackened, bubbled mass of scarring on the sleek, ovoid craft. She had seen fire-damaged metal, and this material had reacted more akin to skin. The latticework of distorted metal resembled the scabs of grill-seared meat.
Did you cause some of this damage, Durga?
No, we didn't do this. When we first saw the craft, it had already suffered this damage.
Yun wandered over to a table where one of the dead Nephilim lay. Hannah moved over to join the matron beside the corpse. The creature's chest sported 5 gunshot wounds, starred craters in the flexible alloy that wrapped his torso. Smears where bullets had glanced off crisscrossed its muscular body.
What is that? The false god's children wear a sheath of smart alloy. The false one so envied the love between Enki and the Nagata that he crafted this imperfect progeny. They are like us in many ways. Strong, armored, beautiful, but they are without the nobility inherent in us, for their master only had bitterness in his dark heart. Without the power to love, he had to make up for his mindless children's weakness with the tools of the Anunnaki. As such, they are not more than automatons.
And yet, Enlil returned to the Earth, while our father has abandoned us.
Yun glared at her son for a long, silent moment. Hannah could feel the tension like an electrical charge that wafted in the air.
You know the legends, Durga, and yet you deny that the False One and his clan were cast down, exiled to this world. Our calling, handed down from Enki himself, is to watch and guard the Earth, lest the Dark Brotherhood make their play.
Oh, is that what we were doing when Tiamat loomed in orbit?
Do not speak to your mother like that!
Mind your place, egg layer!
The Starborn Dragon was laid low by those we have been charged to watch over. The three heads rose to the challenge and in the end succeeded, aided by the False God's own greed and pettiness. Our assistance was not needed. Not that you made any effort to contact them, Durga.
The three heads. The rebels from Cerberus. There were more than three of them, don't forget.
The heart of that group are the three. Three whose true souls stretch back to the time when the Dragon Kings and the Twa'ha de Danann first strode the Earth as masters.
Regardless of the myths we're discussing, this craft is loaded with technology and weaponry. A few repairs and it's...
You would draw the attention of those who own this ship.
Look at them. The owners don't seem to be in any position to complain. Unless you hear some kind of muffled groans coming from those rotting hides. They were alone, stranded in the wilderness, and had been camped out there for months. Were any of the Dragon Kings alive, surely they would not have left useful minions, especially after the death of Tiamat.
Enlil is not all-knowing. If our creator, peace be upon him, was not omniscient, then his brother, a pale shadow, could never be so.
Durga's scaled brow arched as if Yun's comment had kick-started gears working in his mind. Hannah had seen such scheming in Durga's face too many times before. The expression chilled her blood. If Yun was aware of Durga's plotting, she paid it no mind.
I have seen enough, son.
I want to search for more of these ships. Think of the power.
Enough to throw away your freedom.
I won't trade my liberty for strength. But just look. The armor can be retracted. And when it is deployed again, it self-repairs. Throw in the built-in energy guns.
We are just looking at more of the same. Agile aircraft, personal weaponry, communications. We already have all of that. And let's not forget the real power we possess. Is there anything on that ship more destructive than a nuclear warhead?
Tiamat.
What?
Tiamat is more powerful than our paltry warheads.
She is dead. As Matron Yun just said.
The ship is inactive, but there are still treasures in its belly. Just imagine if we could take the skimmer up to Tiamat's corpse. What else could have survived? Improvements on the Cobra Bats. Genetic alterations that could make us as immortal as the Anunnaki.
Immortality has no temptation for my old bones.
What about bringing Father back?
Do as you will. I am tired of your ambitions.
The matron pivoted on her heel and strode from the hangar. Hannah glared at Durga.
What are you gawking at?
I have no idea anymore.
Was it something I said?
You just said that Garuda could be cloned, replaced with a lookalike, just as if he were a pet.
Tiamat's technology could reconstruct my father, atom for atom, cell for cell. This would be true resurrection, not the fabrication of a cheap knockoff.
Do you realize what you're saying?
That Tiamat can make me a god? As mighty as Enki himself?
Manticore touched the side of his head. The bodyguard had been standing by quietly, only noticeable when Durga's anger threatened to explode. In his role as protector, he had a backup duty to keep Hannah in touch with news from the rest of the Naga Kingdom. As such, he wore a small earpiece that blended into the shadowy scales on the underside of his cobra hood.
Mistress, sire. Communications is picking up a signal inside of our frontier.
A signal? What from and to whom?
From an exploratory team originating from a place called Cerberus Redoubt. They're transmitting directly to us, apparently.
Cerberus.
Cain, Grant, and Baptiste. Perhaps they came here because of your prize, Durga.
It is ours now. The humans have no right to be on our land, let alone taking something I fought for. This is our...
Silence!
Yun stood in the doorway that she'd exited through only moments before. Just as Hannah had been alerted, so had the Queen. She was back, returning upon being informed of the radio activity.
Mother, damn it!
Don't say another word. The heroes of Cerberus have saved your life. The life of every organism on this planet on many occasions.
Humans
are not a monolithic, single-minded entity. We have threats from their quarter, true. But not all the creations of Enlil are our enemy. Men are as independent as we are. That is why he created those abominations on your morgue tables. I have made my decision. And we will welcome the three heads of justice with open arms. What do you have to hide?
Our nation's security? We are a people under siege by mammalian threats. What didn't the Millennial Consortium's intrusion tip you off, you dim old bat?
Yes. They tested you so much. You're not even blind in your scarred eye. Besides, we have an army with attack helicopters and assault rifles, and we are one of the few nuclear powers on Earth. The Cerberus Explorers are only a handful of people on a peaceful mission.
Damnation.
All newcomers are not your enemy, son. Especially these particular new arrivals. We owe the existence of our world to them. They wish to greet us in peace.
Liars. Obscuring the facts to hide their self-serving motives. Our world is secure because I kept the apes at bay.
They may not be worthy to you, but your bitterness blinds you. One error, and you have nothing left but venom. Even for your own kind.
Error? Garuda's murder was an error?
Shut up!
Respect your mother, if not her crown.
Durga glared at Hannah, but the tension in Manticore's arms stilled any further response.
Durga, you will take Hannah and Manticore with you to greet the visitors from Cerberus. They will be my eyes and ears. Should a conflict arise, they will report whether you are guiltless or a victim of your unthinking, all-consuming bigotry.
And if Cain and his ilk kill Hannah and her love-struck pet?
Then I will not have a grandchild, and you will have to find some other Nagani woman with whom to engage in your perversions.
Manticore folded his arms, the corner of his mouth turning up in smug approval. The air in the hangar thickened with the promise of violence. A scream of rage struggled to hatch inside Hannah's throat. If Durga insisted on an altercation, Hannah wasn't certain if she could restrain herself from a few cheap shots to assist Manticore. Her fingers knotted into tight fists.
Come with me to the communications center, Hannah. Durga, put your toys away, and you can join us when your blood has cooled down.
Yes, Mother.
Thank you, Matron.
Hannah and Manticore followed the Queen and her personal guard out of the hangar, leaving the embittered prince to calm down. Fargo looked nervously to the other members of the Cerberus expedition as he waited with them. Lakesh caught the anxious expression on the archaeologist's face.
Worried that Durga will not be the most welcoming of hosts, Fargo?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm certain I put a pretty good crease in his face with my whip.
You have a knack for developing deep, loving friendships everywhere, don't you? That's the risk of doing business, I guess.
Business? More like bullshit.
Isn't there some kind of a big phallic compensation firearm you should be fondling, Grant?
Suddenly, Grant's massive hand wrapped around Fargo's throat.
Pardon me? Could you speak up?
He lifted Fargo off the ground with one hand so that the man's toes dangled inches off the ground.
Grant, you don't want to kill him. I know he's a prick, but that's no reason to stink up the temple with his corpse.
You're lucky that this used to be someone's holy ground.
Oh, I thank my stars that you're so gentle.
Keep in mind, my goodwill does have a limit.
Right. You're not just a pack animal.
Not much of an apology, but I'll take it.
I've spotted aircraft.
Bridget lowered a pair of rangefinder binoculars. The explorers had set themselves atop the roof of the temple in order to limit access by patrols from the forest and to give themselves better visibility of the surrounding region. Grant strode closer to a Stinger missile that he had brought along. Bridget and Cain swept the horizon, making certain that the three approaching aircraft were alone.
This is a the Naga, addressing the Cerberus expedition. Are you receiving my signal?
We have you, Hanna. We just saw your aircraft come over the horizon.
Dr. Singh, I presume.
Please, most of my friends call me Lakesh. Your English is excellent. How did you learn it?
As you know, India has always been a multilingual and multicultural nation. The use of English is a way around provincial and tribal dialects, as well as making it easier to know who our friends and enemies are.
And I presume we are considered friends.
The Naga know the debt owed to Cain, Grant, and Bridget Baptiste by the whole world. The heroes of Cerberus are legendary. Without their efforts, the Earth would have perished many times over.
Why can't we meet more groups like this?
Can't just be happy with being a big damned hero to the snakes, can you, Grant?
The Naga hear many things, including monitoring your communications and those of your enemies. The royal family is honored by your presence, so much that it sends to you the heir to the throne and his princess to show our gratitude for your discovery of our kind.
Cain sized up Hannah's acknowledgement and how it would affect their interaction. Both groups would treat each other with respect, but the Naga had advanced knowledge of the Cerberus expedition. Except for mythology and speculation, backed by the reports of a grave robber, Cain and his allies were in the dark about the snake people. Still, Cain's point man's instinct remained cool and quiet. Except for the flash of psychic awareness, no threats loomed to trigger a fight-or-flight response. Though he was observing the Deathbird gunship accompanying the two transports, it wasn't on an aggressive flight pattern. The armed aircraft were not a threat on the part of the Naga. The attack helicopter broke formation and stayed far from the temple, out of the effective range of its 50-caliber machine guns. Lakesh looked at Cain, confused by the separation of the gunship from the other helicopters.
What are they doing?
The gunship is for the protection of the royals on one of the transports. Since it's not meant to harm us, it will orbit the temple, alert for threats against their people, but trusting us not to attack the transports, as well as throw in to protect the aircraft in case of danger. It's a show of submission, akin to when wolves present their throats to an alpha male. They're saying that they're not a threat to us.
Grant broke down the Stinger missile and put it back in its travel case.
Of course, we don't know if those are members of the royal family. They could be lying, and this is a trap.
True, but your skepticism hasn't kept you from stowing our rocket launcher.
You haven't gotten me killed yet, and you dragged me through all colors of shit.
We'll be all right for now.
And Durga?
I told them you were here with us, Fargo. They'll tolerate you.
Domi jabbed Fargo in the ribs.
Stick with us, and maybe you'll get a seat at the table instead of being stowed with the pack animals.
Fargo glared at Domi, but held his tongue. The Blackhawks and their serpentine passengers approached for a landing on the roof of the temple. The next few minutes would confirm whether the Cerberus warriors had formed an alliance or had become ensnared in a den of deadly vipers. Durga watched Hannah as she spoke into the radio, conversing with Lakesh. Framed in the open door of the helicopter, she was a vision of serpentine beauty, her face expressing a regal bearing that made her seem fully worthy of being his pure-blooded queen. She was a willful woman, prepared to stand up to him rather than buckle under to his authority, his fearful rages. Pangs of respect for her struggled against his grim temperament and monomania, but he fought that admiration back down. Love was not meant for beings as exalted as he was. He suspected that the fires of dignity, so strong in him, had been doused in Hannah by her petty concerns for lesser creatures. Her willfulness could just be the last heat from those dying embers. Enlil was correct about the Naga people. The once mighty and proud Cobra men had spent far too long huddled beneath the dirt. By mixing with humans, the Naga had taken on the aspect of worms, pink and soft, instead of commanding the fragile, unarmored mammals with impunity. Suddenly, the world began to blur around Durga. A white, featureless universe faded in. The sensations of the world disappeared, even though he knew that he was still sitting in the helicopter next to Hannah. He smiled, turning his thoughts into dialogue. Durga had been drawn into a plane of telepathic existence.
I was just thinking about you, Enlil.
Why do you think I made psychic contact with you? You are seeing the truth of my assertions and of the feeble beings that surround you.
I have always known of my dissonance with the other Naga.
Of course.
The bleached-out surroundings began to resolve, filling with color and shape. They took on the semblance of Durga's royal chambers, except that the Anunnaki god sat in a high-backed chair.
A comfortable seat you've selected for yourself, Durga.
Hana might wonder why I'm sitting beside her like a zombie. Do you have a purpose to this visit to my psyche, or do you just want me to look as if I truly am insane?
What you are experiencing is only the illusion of time's passage. Your mind is expanding the impulse of our communication so as to render our conversation in a manner that can be understood. In reality, what you perceive as 5 minutes here is a mere flicker of a moment between heartbeats.
And apparently I'll need the whole 5 minutes, since you don't seem to be getting to the point.
Well, patience for your inferiors is a sign of weakness, Durga. I remind you that respect for your peers is not...
Calling me your peer... So, have you got something stuck in your craw?
I heard the exchange between the interfering apes from Cerberus and your people. And my own more conventional communications have noted that they are listening to my conversations with the Nephilim.
You deride them as inferior creatures. But they are the ones who are walking to us in the open while the god skulks, hiding in the shadows like a frightened rat. On top of that, they come as visitors. Why, you are attempting to cut deals with the children of one you call a lesser god.
Those observations are why I call you my peer, Prince. Just because King and his allies are human, there is no reason to underestimate the threat that they pose.
Unfortunately, my mother is under the assumption that she retains relevance. Outright elimination of them is out of the question. Those loyal to her would resist any semblance of defiance of her authority.
So I am not the only god forced to scurry in the underbrush, seeking the allegiance of others.
In that case, my apologies for my previous accusation.
I was a new, young, and brash god once. Of course, that was years ago, before life on your world developed internal skeletons. But I do understand the initial rush that comes with ultimate power.
Durga held his tongue, but his imagination betrayed him, constructing the image of Enlil as a doddering old man shaking a bony fist. Enlil regarded the psychic effigy.
I suppose I deserve that.
My apologies, sire.
Enlil gestured, and the false image froze solid. Cracks spread across the effigy's surface, rendering it asunder.
Remember what I said about respect, brash. We can both benefit from our alliance, but it is all dependent on our combined efforts. Betrayal and jealousy tore my brothers from unchallenged command of the skies, giving Cain and his apes all that they needed to thwart us.
You won't have anything to fear from me. I need you. You need the Naga.
And you do not need Cain catching on to you. Be on your guard. He is formidable. Both mentally and physically. All three of them, Cain, Grant, and Baptiste, are far more capable and cunning than any enemy you've ever faced.
I'll watch myself. You do the same, sire. They might already be aware of your presence, due to the dropship that you gave me.
They can suspect, but it will take a serious misstep on your part to spur them to action against our alliance. We have to approach this slowly and steadily. Patience with inferiors is one thing.
But waiting to achieve a goal is far different. I've waited 30 years for my kingdom.
As I have waited 3 decades for you.
The throne room disappeared and was replaced with the Battle of Skyspear. Garuda stood clutching a smoking, empty missile launcher. It was only an image, but it loomed over the two conspirators. The Naga King lowered the empty launcher, relief crossing his face that the repulsion of the Magistrate invasion was complete. A flaming death bird smeared the air with its oily smoke trail. The Warrior King turned, looking back to his son, himself a warrior prince, to share a quiet, celebratory smile of victory. Durga gripped the handles of the heavy machine gun. Powerful, massive bullets, the same kind that the Deathbirds had fired, tore through Garuda's body. Durga's driver, the only other Cobra survivor present, couldn't believe the king's gruesome assassination. The prince leveled a magistrate's captured machine pistol on the driver. Enlil strode through the illusion, resting a clawed hand on Durga's shoulder.
I defeat my own life. Your victorious first step in your ascension. I was unaware at the time how our destinies would be entwined.
That day, I became the son of a god. As a fallen champion, my father was deified.
And as the lone survivor and reporter of the events of his death, a glow of divinity transferred to you. The son of a god is himself a god, which is why your cadre worship you, why they sacrifice their lives for you in battle against the Mammals.
Durga had a twinge of fear, discomfort, raised by the touch of the Anunnaki. At once, he experienced terror and delight. Drunk on psychic energy, body humming with a power that filled him from head to toe, he wanted to swoon into Enlil's embrace. He fought that urge, some instinct keeping him standing.
Power. It's the ultimate aphrodisiac. You would have to be dead not to feel arousal at the prospects of immortality and unlimited power.
Durga smiled, feeling the earphones in the slits on the side of his head. The world began to vibrate, and the warmth of Hannah's skin touched his as they sat in the Blackhawk.
What are you smiling about?
Meeting legends.
I thought you hated humans, especially magistrates.
Cain and Grant are no more magistrates than the Naga are mere mammals. They have transcended their previous existence, remaking themselves as crusaders for liberty and as explorers of the unknown. Their battles against those that rain tragedy upon the Naga are the stuff of legend. It took a while, but Mother's words got through to me. I owe them my life.
Even though they brought Fargo along with them, even with your face still in...
My eye, my scar.
The helicopter prepared to land atop the ancient temple. The Cerberus expedition stood, waiting for the Naga envoys.
I think it adds character to my face. Fargo is slime, but he escaped from my ambush. No man has ever done that before. So, he's earned my respect. He's also gained a reprieve from my vengeance.
Durga noted Hannah's nervous glance at Manticore. She was confused by the sudden mercy and diplomacy he displayed. The bodyguard watched Durga carefully, hand never straying far from the Pinedad sidearm in its hip holster.
Smiles, you two. We were sent on a mission of peace and unity. Best face forward, and all that.
Hannah and Manticore looked at each other in dismay. Durga let them stew in their suspicions. It wasn't as if the princess and her warrior would betray the sudden turn in Durga's attitude to strangers. Besides, killing the explorers wouldn't do. He needed scapegoats. Cain, to all appearances, was relaxed, his limbs loose. To the uninitiated, it would have appeared that he was unprepared for any sudden violence. But to those in the know, from his position, he moved like liquid. Not only was he not committed to any specific response by remaining relaxed, but he also appeared to be less of a threat, a useful tactic when there was the potential for a peaceful meeting and the fostering of a beneficial alliance. The Naga's air fleet was impressive. And in the reconstructed America, a squadron or two of transport aircraft would prove to be worth their weight in gold. Just as the Black Hawk helicopter flared for a landing, Kane's instincts buzzed. Something was wrong. It wasn't the Deathbird gunship. The attack helicopter was still far off, keeping its distance from the temple. Both Bridget and Grant noticed his tension immediately. Domi picked up on his preternatural reaction to danger only seconds after the others. Kane frowned, realizing that if Domi hadn't noticed a threat with her sharp, feral senses, then perhaps Kane's perceptions had gone awry. The ex-magistrate, however, had little cause to doubt his danger sense. It wasn't an immediate menace. There were no indications of a sniper or an ambush. Instead, it was a tickle at the back of his mind, his subconscious feeling that things were out of place.
What is it?
Something I can't put my finger on. But it can't be anything solid. Otherwise, we'd have both locked on to it.
Temples have been responsible for enhanced paranormal visions for you before. Perhaps you're having another prophetic episode, like back in Greece?
It wasn't a vision. More like I heard something. A whisper.
Like mental telepathy. You know, direct speech between two or more minds.
I know telepathy. Give me a break, Lakesh. Balaam exposed me to enough of it. Probably screwed my brain up so I can pick up that crap from now on.
My apologies, friend Kane. I meant specifically, did it sound like a two-way conversation?
Not really. It was like catching a fleeting snippet of conversation. I only heard or sensed one voice, so I couldn't tell.
Between whom?
Quiet. Fargo's coming over. Could be the one in contact. Or maybe one of the snakes on the helicopter.
Or both.
The Cerberus explorers fell silent at the implication of that threat. Alone, in the middle of the subcontinent, there was no way to tell who was friend or foe. And even with the Deathbird a mile distant, there were enough Cobra men on the two transport helicopters to make their lives very bloody and brutal.
What the hell was all that chin-wagging? Because if you guys are planning something stupid...
Like traveling with you? Shut up, Fargo. We're not going to war.
Not yet.
Just remember, we can leave you here for the Naga to tear apart. Doesn't matter one shit to me.
Cobra warriors exited the helicopter, flanking two regal figures. Fargo's face paled as he recognized his handiwork in the livid scar and unnatural glare in Durga's eye. The other serpentine figure was smaller, slender, and most decidedly female. She was possessed of a deceptively delicate appearance. Brigid and Lakesh advanced to greet the royal pair, while Domi, Grant, and Kane stood loose and alert to balance the Naga soldiers. Durga looked at Fargo for a moment.
So, you brought this one back to me?
Figured that we'd bring you a housewarming present. This was the closest thing to a 6-foot rat that we could find.
Fargo's eyes widened in alarm as Durga strode to him, literally a serpent sizing up panicked prey. After a moment of letting the man sweat, Durga extended his hand.
Well played, Fargo. If any mammal has earned my respect personally, it is you. Present company excluded.
No offense taken.
Kane could pick up a sense of dissonance from Hannah, the Naga princess. The tall, silent warrior at her side also displayed some confusion over Durga's actions. It was hard to read their exact emotions through their scaled features, but they were put off balance by Durga's behavior. Lakesh shot Kane a silent but quizzical expression. Kane nodded to the scientist. No bloodshed was planned. For now.